Okay, our next case is 22-3160, Countryman Rossburn versus Muma. And for the appellant is Mr. Rupp.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Disgruntled with various aspects.
Please identify yourself. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead and identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Michael Raup on behalf of Dr. Richard Muma. Disgruntled with various aspects of her employment at the university, the plaintiff in this case filed a 918-paragraph complaint that asserted 27 counts against the university and five individual administrators. A dozen of those claims survived the motion to dismiss, and the plaintiff is currently litigating various claims of discrimination against the university and district court. With respect to the claims against the individual defendants, the court dismissed all but one claim against one individual defendant. The others failed to state a claim, and the individual defendants were also entitled to qualified immunity. And we're here today on that one remaining claim against the one individual defendant, which the district court permitted to survive the motion to dismiss. And it did so despite plaintiff's failure to identify any clearly established authority illustrating in any factually similar scenario an equal protection violation. We submit that that was error on both prongs of the qualified immunity analysis. As the court's aware, it has a discretion to analyze those prongs in either order as it sees most efficient to evaluate the case. As we argued in the reply and as we reiterate here today, we believe the easiest way for the court to do so is on the second prong, is on the clearly established prong. And the reason for that is if you look at plaintiff's briefing to this court, they identify one case that they claim provides clearly established authority here. And not only do they just cite one case, the Murrell versus Denver School District case, they articulate the supposed right at the highest level of generality. And if you look at the quote that they cite, it articulates that in the Tenth Circuit, it has been clearly established since 1989 that sexual harassment can violate the 14th Amendment, and that supervisory liability as a theory has been around since 1992. And that's all they have to say about the clearly established nature of this right. But that flies in the face of all of the recent Supreme Court authority on exactly this question. If the court looks to City of Tahlequah versus Bond, White versus Purdy, Casella versus Hughes, any District of Columbia versus Westby, you can line them up over the last six or seven terms of the Supreme Court. The court has been unwavering in its requirement that we evaluate particularized facts in specific circumstances and that you have to analogize those to the petition or to the complaint.
Were any of those equal protection cases?
They were not, no. And Your Honor is correct in noting, I think, where Your Honor's question is going, that it is a more exacting standard in the Fourth Amendment context. We require more factually analogous cases in those circumstances. But that does nothing for the consistent line of authority that we don't allow just the articulation of the right at the highest level of generality, which is all that we have here. No facts of any cases are discussed by the plaintiff in the district court briefing, nor in the briefing to this court. So all we have is that high level of generality statement. And candidly, in light of this court's recent decision in Frey versus Town of Jackson, we think this should be the end of the case.
What about Elder versus Holloway, where I think the Supreme Court said that for purposes of qualified immunity, courts are the courts, and we have to determine what the clearly established law is based on our own research, our own recognition of what the law is.
I think you're right, Your Honor, that the court could look to other cases. A couple of points on this. First, in Frey versus Town of Jackson, I think it's footnote 9 of that opinion, this court, in analyzing the clearly established discussion, said it's not this court's job to make arguments for the appellant or to essentially dig up authority that's not cited by the plaintiff. So I think there is authority from this court articulating that the court need not do so. Could the court go outside of that? I think yes, as you've identified, the court has the discretion to do so. The second point I'd make on that is that the cases that we would look to then intuitively would be the two cases that the district court cited, right, in its brief discussion of the clearly established prong, which was the Johnson and the Fye case from this court. In our opening brief, we clearly identified the distinguishing characteristics in those cases, and I'll mention what I think is the most significant one in a moment. But I think it's very telling that neither of those cases are discussed in plaintiff's response brief. We think that's a telling concession, that there are significant distinguishing characteristics and that they can't clearly establish a right. But even if you look to those cases in specifically, the key distinction in any of these cases, whether it's Morrell or Johnson or Fye, is that the person who was in possession of the information, who received the report about discrimination, was the only one who knew about it and was standing as an impediment to an investigation occurring or to anything being done at the agency or at the government entity. Here, plaintiff admits that the office of the university that was designated to conduct investigations into allegations of discrimination was doing so at the time. And we're not aware of any case from any jurisdiction, certainly not this jurisdiction, that says when that factual scenario presents itself, that there is some separate, independent, and importantly, individual constitutional obligation on an administrator to do something different.
Well, you probe that a little bit. I don't know that they say what you characterize it. They say the OIEC purported to do one, and it was a sham investigation. They really didn't do anything, is what they said.
So I agree with your characterization that they call it a sham investigation. I think there are a couple of problems with that. There were two OIEC proceedings that occurred. In the first, she claims that she was interviewed, and then the OIEC decided to proceed no further and not conduct an additional investigation. Then there was a separate later OIEC proceeding that she disagreed with the outcome of and claims was a quote unquote sham. So with respect to that allegation, because I think that's the only way that they attempt to get around this problem, I think there's a few issues. One, there's no case saying that that would bring it in the ambit of clearly established authority. That if all of a sudden an administrator thinks that this is a and there's not even an allegation that he believed it was a sham investigation, right? That if there exists a sham investigation, that could give rise to a clearly established equal protection violation. But secondly, and I think critically here, because it is an individual claim against Dr. Muma in his individual capacity, there's no allegation that he had any involvement in the investigation, that he had any responsibility for the investigation. And if the court looks to its precedent, I believe it's Tonkovich versus University of Kansas, this court was exacting about that requirement, that when you are looking at individual Section 1983 claims, it's important that you not impute the responsibilities of the institution into responsibilities of an individual. And it's important from an equitable perspective.
Well, he was the provost at least part of the time. Wouldn't he have some responsibility over the office, the OIEC process?
It is not alleged that he had any direct responsibility over the OIEC process. That doesn't appear in the complaint. As a matter of the university's organizational chart, I don't know the answer to that question. That's not in the record. In the sort of hypothetical sense, would he have some sort of supervisory responsibility? I suppose just in the abstract, since he's a leader within the institution. But again, I'll take the court back to the Tonkovich decision. That it was in the due process context, so it's a little bit different. But it was the dean of the law school, and there was a discrimination, there was a complaint within the law school, and a professor was making the allegation that they didn't have, that they weren't given sufficient process before they were disciplined. And this court articulated that while the dean has, some sort of abstract supervisory authority, it's not his individual responsibility to provide due process. That obligation flowed to the institution itself.
I thought your argument in the reply brief was that there was, at the time of the November 2019 allegations that there was a pending investigation by that office.
That's correct. That's correct.
Okay, because I thought you just said that both investigations had been concluded.
If I did, I misspoke, and I apologize for that. The first investigation process had concluded, and the second was pending at the time.
And the second investigation, that was precipitated by different facts, or basically her allegations of ongoing harassment?
The allegations of ongoing harassment were what formed the basis of that ongoing proceeding at the time. And that's a good segue, Your Honor, to prong one. If we get to prong one, the main contention there is the statute of limitations issue. That what the district court did in looking at, well, the district court correctly acknowledged that many of the allegations were outside of the statute of limitations. If you look to the analysis that the court did in finding that there was a constitutional claim alleged, is then relied on exactly those facts that were out, the allegations that were outside of the statute of limitations to say that there was a sufficient constitutional claim. If you look to the only allegation that is time that would be within the statute of limitations, it's one sentence, it's paragraph 288 of the complaint. And all it says is that she made an additional assertion to Dr. Mumma about her claims of discrimination. It says nothing about what he did with that. It says nothing about how he reacted. There are no allegations.
What about paragraph 289, which is the passive voice paragraph?
The passive voice paragraph about how she was then fired. Two problems with that. First is that the district court, as opposed to quoting it as in passive voice, attributed that to Dr. Mumma without her saying so. So we think that's error in its own right. But secondly, if you look at this court's precedents, Brown and also Paul's, we require the specific articulation of the individual constitutional responsibility. So I don't believe that, I certainly don't think it could follow as a matter of law that because it appeared in the next paragraph that can be attributed to him. If there are any further questions at this time, I'd reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. My name is Alexander Edelman, and I'm here on behalf of Dr. Countryman Roseworm, who is the appellee in this case.
Can we pick up with paragraph 289?
Yes.
And specifically, what is it that you wanted the provost to do in November 2019? And wasn't there an investigation that was indeed going on? And third, what about that passive voice?
Our position is that there was nothing that could be meaningfully considered an investigation going on. There was, if you looked at the petition, there were the two processes. The second process was actually triggered by a request from another official, but all of the facts point to that process having no meaningful protection. And in fact, counsel suggested that there's no allegation that Dr. Mumma believed it was a scam. That's not correct. In paragraph 224, the allegation is that he specifically told her that she was never going to get relief through that process.
Even if you don't like it and you think the investigation wasn't ever going to amount to anything or be conducted in good faith or whatever else, doesn't the provost have to know that? In other words, isn't it enough for the provost to say there's an investigation going on and the last thing the investigators need is the provost sticking his nose into it?
Well, he did know that. And again, I would suggest that under the standard for a motion to dismiss, where it is the facts and the inferences are made in favor of the petitioner, of the plaintiff, him telling her that it would never be resolved through that process is, I can be inferred from that he knew and believed that, right? That he understood that this whole process was a sham, was meaningless, and was not in any way going to protect her rights. And so in that sense, and there are other allegations in paragraphs 220, around 220, 226, that he actually warned her that, that she shouldn't go forward with this and it could be harmful to her. So the notion that he, you know, it would be almost analogous to, the fact that, that there was this process, right? The fact that there was, the process really doesn't, I think, protect him in any way, again, because he knows. And the petitions, at this point, right, he knows, the petition makes clear, the complaint, I'm sorry, that this process did not protect her rights, that it was a sham at best and was maybe going to make, cause her harm at worst. And so again, I think you can't, that doesn't then distinguish it factually, from the other cases. And so I would point to, in terms of the...
That allegation, that statement was made before the was before the statute of limitations had run. So don't you need to link up some allegations about conduct that was within the statute of limitations, so sometime in October of 2019?
Well, so I would put forth that that the trial court at this stage, the district court, correctly ruled that the statute of limitations didn't apply at the motion to dismiss stage because of a lack of clarity. But even if it did apply, under the Morgan, I think it's Morgan case, that things that occurred outside the statute of limitations can still be evidence of the discriminatory nature of the allegation. So if he, even
are you
if he
relying
said,
on the continuing violation doctrine now, or
well, so
something different.
Setting that aside, right? Even without the continuing violation doctrine, the fact that if he told her him making the statement that this process is a sham, right, and that there's no validity to it. Even if he said that before the statute of limitations, that still impugns to, right, that still is evidence of what the process was after the statute of limitations occurred, right? Unless there's some reason to believe that became not true in the interim. That pleading and those events, right, that happened prior, that is still evidence and still a factual basis about, again, this process, which was a sham, and as the facts taken as true show.
But you haven't alleged that Dr. Mumad knew that it was a sham.
Well, again, I think that in paragraph 224 we do, that when he tells her that she'll never get, that this process will never resolve it, that the reasonable inference from that is that he knows that statement to be true, right, which is therefore.
Well, let me kind of, yeah. let me ask you a hypothetical question. Let's say I'm the president of a law firm and I have an employee at the firm who is claiming that they are the subject of brutality, of misconduct from a co-employee, and that my law firm has an investigating agents, you know, entity that is independent. Let's say it's an outside law firm and they conduct their investigation. And they come back and they decide, no, that the allegation is not true. And let's say the employee that is the complainant doesn't believe it, you know, that it was an investigation that was conducted with integrity, but it was an independent investigation, whether it was valid or not. I'm the president of a law firm. I don't know. I didn't investigate it. And I say, you know, let's say the February 2019 comment. Let's say I say, look, there was an investigation. You're making really pretty specific, arguably defamatory accusations about Joshua Lamazel, the employee. There's an investigation that is confirmed that you did not, were not the victimized by Joshua Lamazel. You might want to be careful. If you continue to say that, Joshua Lamazel has a pretty good defamation claim against you. How can I say that is a violation of some clearly established rule?
So
when there was an investigation, whether Dr. Buma liked it or not liked it or or thought it was a sham or not.
Well, I mean, so again, in your hypothetical, if the president of the law firm or whoever it is picked that outside allegedly independent entity because he knew that they would never validate that they would always find against the employee and always find a lack of discrimination, right? Which is, again, applying the standard, what is alleged in this petition. I don't think that's any kind of protection.
So you're saying that if I read every paragraph of this petition, I'm going to find a specific allegation that Dr. Bhuma handpicked the personnel in the OIEC that conducted the investigation into Dr. Countryman's allegation.
No, but again, in this case, I think the equivalent is, so whether or not he was the one who picked it, if he knew, and the allegation is that he knows, that there's this process offers no protection and is not going to help her. So again, whether, if maybe you as the president of the firm didn't pick it, but the associate picked it, and you knew that they had picked someone who would never fine for the complaining employee.
So what was the provost supposed to do in November 19? 2019. What would you have the provost do that you say no longer liable?
He could have instructed the people who were committing the ongoing harassment to just cut it out. He was in charge of them. He could have said, "Hey, this you are spreading these rumors about this person, saying that she only got her position because she had sex with her supervisor. You're treating her badly. You're committing all these misconduct. Stop doing it. Cut it out." That's the easiest thing he could have done. But instead, he did nothing. And not only did he do nothing, but he kind of told her to let this keep going. Right? He almost kind of supported the discrimination.
Right. You haven't alleged much in the complaint, long complaint, but you haven't alleged much about November 2019. What in those limited allegations plausibly alleges an equal protection claim?
The origin of the equal protection claim is the fact that there was harassment based on her sex, and that as a supervisor with knowledge of it, he acquiesced to that harassment. And so the case law establishes an equal protection violation. I don't have that exact section of the petition in front of me, but again, I think the nature of acquiescence, right, is, and this is where I had discussed the continuing violation doctrine, but even without sort of specifically relying on that doctrine, the nature of acquiescence is that it's ongoing, right? If the instant you hear about, you come to know of constitutionally violating discrimination, you don't do it that second, that can't be acquiescence, right? Acquiescence by its nature requires some amount of time. I'm sure Dr. Moon was a busy man, right? He didn't necessarily need to drop everything and immediately do it. It is the ongoing nature of the fact that this discrimination had been happening for years, the fact that he had actual knowledge of it, and the fact that he continuously allowed it to keep going and never did anything about it. In fact, gave almost support to it, right? I think that would be the argument for that and the nature of that. I did want to mention, so in terms of the it being clearly established, I recognize that in our brief before this court, we only mentioned the Murrell case. In doing so, I thought that the district court opinion laid out pretty clearly the clearly established case law with Johnson and Fye, and I didn't want to just regurgitate that, and so I was trying to address more of appellant's concerns because that language was already in front of the court, and I apologize for not maybe including that more explicitly, but I do think that those cases, and in particular the Fye case, the Fye v. Oklahoma Corporation Commission, does clearly establish that in a scenario very similar to this, where there is a supervisor who allows this kind of discrimination to be ongoing, and that case found not only that that it was a constitutional violation, but that it was clearly established and that qualified immunity shouldn't apply. And so I think...
Did any of those cases involve fact pattern of a pending investigation?
I believe that in the FI case there was an investigation going on. I don't know that it was precisely the exact same. I think it actually kind of started before. But again, I think that at this stage, and given the allegations in the petition, I don't know that again, I think it would be the equivalent of in a Fourth Amendment case, a police officer saying that their excessive use of force there's qualified immunity that they beat a suspect unnecessarily on the roof because the suspect could have jumped off the roof, right? If this investigation process is something that's actually going to be worse for her, according to him, and again, at this stage, that is what the facts say and what should be taken as true, I don't know that pointing to that is provides some sufficient differentiation for the facts, given for the constitutional analysis, right? I think that this is... That in theory could be developed, and in summary judgment, right? That could be a different question. But at this stage, all of the allegations are that this so-called investigation was meaningless, that he knew it was, that he told her it was, right? And that in no way changes the fact, essentially, that he was acquiescing, that he knew the discrimination was going on, he knew that nothing was going to stop it, and he chose not to do anything about it, he told her he wasn't going to do anything about it, and he, in fact, he kind of encouraged it. And so that raises, I think, that meets that clearly established under the case law test, and this sort of shadow of an investigation does not change that constitutionally.
All right, counsel, I think we understand your arguments.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Time's expired. There's a few minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Four quick points on rebuttal. First, there's still no articulation of what the clearly established law is. To answer Your Honor's question, there was not an investigation that was ongoing in the FI case. In fact, the administrator that had knowledge and had the report was someone who had themselves conducted a prior investigation, which that's what gave rise to the equal protection violation. So there was no ongoing investigation. So there's still no articulation of what the clearly established authority is, and that's dispositive in this case. Second, as Your Honor correctly noted, all of the allegations that were referred to in paragraph, I believe it was 224, about the investigation being a sham are outside of the statute of limitations window. So I'd refer the court to all of the briefing that we have on the continuing violation doctrine or the repeated violation doctrine. Neither of those apply here, and they were also waived before the district court. Third, I think Judge Phillips' question, the answer to your question about what should the provost have done here is a very telling answer, because the answer is that he should have independently taken some disciplinary action against the individuals that she was accusing of discrimination, and do so while there was a separate investigation going on at the time into those allegations. I'm not aware of any authority that would establish, certainly clearly establish, that that's his role. And in fact, I think if we looked into it, the authority would probably cut the other direction, that it would create due process problems or all sorts of liability if he was acting outside the scope of the investigation that was occurring at the time. But certainly nothing clearly established. Fourth and finally, in this case in particular, this court should have no hesitation to hold plaintiff to her burden to identify clearly established authority. This is not your run-of-the-mill qualified immunity in a 1983 case where the entirety of the claim is going to rise or fall on the assertion of qualified immunity. We see that a lot of times in 1983 circumstances, right, where everything rises and falls because of qualified immunity, because there's unavailability of other remedies, there's state sovereign immunity or any number of doctrines that are precluding the plaintiff from making other claims. Here, that's not the case. She believes this is a sham investigation, and she's pursuing right now those claims in the district court. For all of these reasons, we'd ask this court to reverse the order of the district court and direct entry of judgment in favor of Dr. Muma.
Okay, thank you, counsel. You're excused, and the case shall be submitted.